I call you, ladies and gentlemen. You know what you are. See Life's Other Self, The Hidden Part, stories of women who love women and men that love men. See their side. Hear them out. Don't have a closed mind. Be open before making your decision. See Gay Liberation. Every family with relatives is involved. Out of the closet and into the streets. Gay Liberation.
You are listening to Queer Review on CHOW 94.9. Queer Review is an association with the Pride Library at the University of Western Ontario. To find out more about our show and the Pride Library, please visit chrwradio.com, queerreviewradio.blogspot.com, and uwo.ca/pridelib. My name is John. You're listening to Queer Review on CHRW 94.9. I have a guest here named Professor Gary Kinsman. He's a sociology professor at Laurentian University, author of many books, The Regulation of Desire, Sociology for Changing the World, and Who's National Security? And today I'm going to be specifically talking about his latest book, The Canadian War on Queers, which, by the way, I was really excited about when I saw it. I thought it looked really, really good, really thick, and I was glad that someone was dealing with the topic, so I want to thank you right away. And how are you?
I'm doing pretty good today.
Great. I wanted to start off with you. How did you come to write this book?
Well, as you've already noted, I'd done previous research on sexual regulation in Canada, including the book The Regulation of Desire you just referred to, that basically covered the 50s and 60s in a lot of detail in terms of lesbian and gay experiences and the emergence of queer communities and also the emergence of heterosexuality as an institutionalized social norm in Canada. So when Dean Beebe, who was an enterprising journalist, still is, with Canadian Press, got a whole series of documents released in 1992 under the Access to Information Program, and these were documents that referred directly to the organization of the national security campaigns against lesbians and gay men, I thought it would be worthwhile for me to try to pursue this topic in more detail, that is, bringing together the oral historical work that I'd done and the people I knew, already knew I could talk to who'd had first-hand experiences with the national security campaigns, with a critical interrogation of the documents that were released by the national security regime under the Access to Information Program. So it was basically from 1993 on until very recently, I've been engaged in this research on the social organization of the national security campaigns against lesbians and gay men in the Canadian context, basically from the 1950s through to today. And along the way, I hired a number of people to assist me in terms of doing research assistance. One of them was Patricia Gentile, who teaches now in women's studies at Carleton University. And even though she started off as a research assistant, she eventually became a full sort of partner in the writing of this book. So I'm the co-author of the book. She's especially responsible for the Access to Information Program requests and a lot of the analysis around gender relations that exists in our book.
I would like to connect with her at some point. I had a question about, well, many, and a general interest about the Freedom of Information Act and all the other acts that allow this. I don't know if people realize how easy it is to do, but I was wondering what the experience was for you, because I've heard, you know, I followed a little bit online, and Canada is supposedly one of the worst for releasing in, I don't know what countries, but there was a study done by some Australian scholars, one of the worst for the access of information. I was wondering what the experience was for you, how easy it was, and what could people, maybe there's something that you could tell us that we could learn so it would make the process easier or more helpful.
Well, Patricia would actually be better to talk to about this than I would, but I should point out that there's lots of problems with the Access to Information Program. It's great that you now can try to access information, and sometimes you can get it. Although I should point out that oftentimes the documents that we would get back from the Access to Information Program office would be, you know, whole bunches of the interesting information we really wanted to read would be blotted out. So we would actually not get some of the information we wanted. We tried to access information that we were sure was there, but we would never be able to get it. It should be clear that under national security provisions, they can actually deny the release of certain types of information. One strategy I would suggest for people if you are trying to use the Access to Information program is to try to make as many different requests as you can for the same or similar information from a number of different government offices, because what we found is that sometimes we would get different information blanked out by different ATIP officers working in different government departments. Let's say the RCMP versus CSIS or versus the military. You would get them blotting out different information, so when you get all of these different access to information requests together, you put all that information together, you could sometimes piece together more of the story that you really wanted to get access to. But really, there are lots of restrictions and lots of problems. One of the things we argue, both in an earlier research report that we did, but also in the book itself, is that these security documents, especially for the 60s and 70s, and probably into the 80s now, should be released. I mean, these are important documents that people should have access to in terms of the historical record in Canada. There is really no reason for the Canadian state to be suppressing the release of this type of information.
I would like to get into a little bit of what you laid out in the book. Is there any chronology that you follow?
Sure, there's certain ways you can construct a chronology. I mean, we should point out that our book is very detailed analysis from 1958, basically, through to the 1990s, when the major campaign against lesbians and gay men as national security risk was organized. Perhaps just to put in place a few features of the book and then to discuss some aspects of a possible chronology, is from 1958 on in Canada, the Canadian government, the security panel, the RCMP, declared lesbians and gay men per se as risks to the national security of Canada because we supposedly suffered from a character weakness that would make us vulnerable to blackmail from evil Soviet agents. I'm being somewhat sarcastic here because of the people we talked to who were directly affected by these national security campaigns, they reported the only people who ever tried to blackmail them was the RCMP itself, trying to get them to give the names of their lesbian and gay friends. There's absolutely no evidence in the Canadian context that any lesbian or gay man was ever blackmailed by an agent of the Eastern Bloc, if you want to refer to it that way, and gave any sort of national security information as a result of that. So there's absolutely no evidence, no shred of evidence, that lesbians and gay men were actually susceptible to blackmail from agents of the Soviet Empire, the Soviet Union. But the RCMP and later on CSIS would actually engage in a fair amount of blackmail work against lesbians and gay men, trying to get us to reveal the names of our friends. Now, if we're going to try to put this in terms of any sort of chronology, we should point out that the high point of the campaign was from the late 50s on through the 1960s. This is the high point of the campaign in the public service. The campaign in the military is basically quite continuous from the late 50s. It actually has earlier roots than that through to the 1990s. It takes until 1992 when the official purge policies of lesbians and gay men from the Canadian military are ended because of the legal challenge brought by Michelle Douglas. But what happens in the 1960s is you have a really intensive campaign focusing at first on external affairs in the Navy, but spreading out to all sorts of different parts of the public service, including the post office. All sorts of areas of government employment that you wouldn't associate with national security become major areas in which there's a basic witch hunt against lesbians and gay men. Thousands of people's names are compiled by the RCMP. By about 1967 or 68, they have a list of 9,000 names of suspected homosexuals in the Ottawa area. And they begin to purge lesbians and gay men from their positions in the civil service and military. They also start to interrogate and do surveillance on lesbians and gay men outside the civil service because they presume that they are going to be their chief source of information. We've talked to some of the RCMP officers who were involved in the security work, and we do know that in Ottawa in that period of time that they would basically try to make friends with gay men because they couldn't really make friends with lesbians at that point in time, according to them. And they would try to find out if people had gone to any gay parties lately, whether there were new civil servants there. They would try to identify them. If they got a number of identifications of those individuals, they would be purged from their positions. Something else that happened in the 1960s was the Canadian government, in its infinite wisdom, tried to develop a so-called scientific detection technology to determine who was lesbian and gay and who wasn't. And if you were determined to be lesbian or gay, you would be purged from your position. That research project was dubbed the Fruit Machine by RCMP officers, male RCMP officers, who feared that even though they would be entered into the research as part of the normal control group, they would be found out to be fruits as a result of this research. So that's how the Fruit Machine name actually got attached to this research. But until about 68, from 62 on, the federal government spent tens of thousands of dollars trying to perfect this technology that was designed to purge lesbians and gay men. It was based on a pupillary response test. They would show you half-naked images of men and women. They would take photographs of pupils of your eye, and depending upon the dilation of your pupil, you were supposed to, in an involuntary way, signal whether you were lesbian, gay, or heterosexual. Well, of course, this research never could work. It was based on totally flawed assumptions, but that's in some ways both a very horrific example of these national security campaigns, and also in some ways also sort of perhaps it's more comedic side as well. But throughout the 1960s, there were major purges of many government departments. External affairs was particularly hard hit, and major purges obviously going on in the military. Now, that's sort of the first period, the late 50s through the 1960s, the sort of most intensive period of the national security campaigns, or what we call the Canadian War on Queers. Then if we sort of move on to the 70s, what's really significant about the 70s is you have the emergence of lesbian and gay liberation movements themselves, starting with a demonstration on Parliament Hill in 1971, which of course was placed under RCMP surveillance. It's important to point out that the surveillance of various different left groups that came to support the lesbian and gay liberation movement, the early lesbian and gay liberation movement, was how the RCMP first found out about the gay liberation movement and began to identify it as a national security risk. But because our movements in the 70s challenged the national security policies, challenged the purge policies in the military and in the civil service, our movements themselves came under the surveillance of the RCMP. So in the early years, in the early to mid-1970s, even lesbian and gay dances were considered to be possible risks to Canadian national security. And it's only later on in the mid-70s that they begin to realize that it's only what they describe as gay political activists who are the real risk. That is, gay activists who are generally young, generally involved in public action and public demonstrations, and also who have ties to the left, who are the real threats. But throughout the 70s, the lesbian and gay liberation movements themselves become a major target of surveillance. And that's one of the reasons why it took us a lot longer to complete this book than we initially thought, because Steve Hewitt, who was doing research on the RCMP surveillance of student organizing all across the country, also came across some of their surveillance by the RCMP of various different lesbian and gay groups on campuses across the country. He shared that research with us, and it became clear to us that part of the story that we had to cover and had to integrate into our book was actually the national security surveillance of lesbian and gay groups in the 1970s. Now, what happens in the 1970s is that lesbian and gay people, lesbian and gay communities, lesbian and gay movements become much more public and visible. This begins in a very preliminary way to undermine some of the national security arguments that were used against lesbians and gay men. The whole supposition was that we didn't want to be out, that we weren't public, and that we had something to hide. Well, when more and more lesbians and gay men came, you know, out publicly and visibly and began to build public communities, this meant that the national security rationale, especially the blackmail rationale, started to fall apart. At the same time, there were major forms of national security policing and also sexual policing that was escalated. You mentioned the Stonewall riots in New York City in 1969, which are in some major ways the beginning points of the contemporary lesbian and gay liberation movements, and they had their effects in Canada. You know, over the next couple of years after 69, a series of lesbian and gay liberation groups were formed. But it's also important to point out that in 1969, there was a shift in the legal regulation of lesbian and gay or queer sexualities more generally, from a total criminalization of all homosexual sexual activity. There was a move to partially decriminalize some homosexual activity if it was done in private, basically behind closed bedroom doors, and if it was done between two consenting adults, with adults being defined as age 21 and over, to try to provide extra special protection for young people from the possible vulnerabilities to homosexual advances. So there was a shift in sexual regulation from a more moral conservative strategy to what could be referred to as a small L liberal strategy in the 1970s. But as lesbian and gay communities became more public and visible, this also meant that our sexualities became more public and visible, and therefore the sex police were actually called down upon us, so that you actually saw an intensification of policing activities against gay sex in particular, but also lesbian sex in the later 70s and into the early 80s, culminating in the massive Bath raids in Toronto in 1981. So there's an expansion of our movements in the 70s, and that begins to undermine the national security campaigns, especially in the public service. They continue on in a very, very intensive way within the military. I would actually want to argue that the major targets of the military purge campaigns were, obviously gay men were included, but there was a particular targeting of lesbians in the military in a purge campaign directed against the military. So I'm now moving into the sort of 1980s period, which has some new characteristics with this massive expansion of lesbian and gay community formation, but also with the enactment of the Charter of Rights, and especially the Equality Rights section of the Charter. But I thought, again, I'd just pause for a moment to see if there are any particular questions you wanted me to go back to on the time period of the 60s or 70s.
Well, maybe it applies. I was wondering about the actual act itself of intercourse. It seems like, from what I read, that it wasn't necessarily that they were trying to uphold that law. It was, and maybe I'm wrong, or maybe it just didn't come under your focus, but it seemed more like they were just trying to discriminate, but they weren't charging people necessarily for any illegal sexual acts. Unless it was in some kind of organized way, like a body house or some kind of something like that. Is that true, or what was happening
there? Partly depends on the time period you're talking about. Prior to 1969,
right? Yeah, that's what I mean. Yes,
that all homosexual sexual activity was illegal. That didn't mean that the police arrested everybody who engaged in it. It also didn't mean that the police were aware of everyone who engaged in it. But it did mean that the police were able to use that as a real threat against people. So, for instance, one of the things that the RCMP would do in the 1960s in Ottawa, where it had some jurisdiction over the parks, is they would actually do park sweeps, and they would round up all the men who were in cruising areas in the parks, and they would basically tell them, we're either going to lay a criminal code charge against you, or you're going to give us the names of all of your friends. So they did use the criminal law as a sort of leverage point to try to blackmail gay men in particular into giving over the names of their lesbian and gay friends.
Can I ask you though, why do you think that they were more interested in knowing than in enforcing the law?
Well, I mean, you also have to remember that there was a lot of enforcement of the law itself during this time period.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There were lots of arrests. I mean, remember that the RCMP was oftentimes the major police force across the Canadian state. But in Ottawa, for instance, there was also the Ottawa Police, there was some jurisdiction of the Ontario Provincial Police, and those squads would have their own morality squads, which would be much more focused on sexual policing. So there were a lot of men who were being arrested for consensual sexual acts throughout this time period. But in relationship to the national security campaigns, how they tried to use the criminal code was as a way of putting pressure or coercion on individuals to give up names. But a lot of people got charged during this period of time, and it actually expands in the post-1969 period. People might think that the partial decriminalization of homosexuality would lead to a lessening of charges. Well, like in other areas where that type of reform came into effect, there was actually a massive expansion of sexual policing. So by the later 70s and early 80s, you have the police using the Indecent Act component of the body house legislation to raid gay bars, gay bathhouses, gay clubs, and to arrest every single person who was there, and lesbian clubs, especially in the lead-up to the Summer Olympics in Montreal in 1976, where basically for a period of time, the police were successful in closing down every single lesbian and gay establishment in Montreal. So there was a coming together, if you want, of national security policing and sexual policing during these years. Perhaps I should also point out one of the most important things we discovered from our research was that lesbians and gay men were never simply just passive victims of these national security campaigns. What we found was even as early as 1964 in Ottawa, people were refusing to give the names of their lesbian and gay friends to the RCMP. We recount a story that we actually start off with in the Canadian War on Queers from a person we've given the pseudonym David to in Ottawa, who describes how in the basement tavern of the Lord Elgin in 1964, prior to the existence of any organized gay community or gay movement in Ottawa, that gay men were actually able to expose RCMP operatives who would come into the basement tavern of the Lord Elgin, who would sit down, who would put a newspaper in front of them, which seemed really odd to people in terms of a supposedly cruising area. And what people would discover was that they had a hole cut in the newspaper, and they would actually be snapping photos of everyone in the bar. What people would do then is not run for cover, not jump under the tables, as you might expect. They would actually all turn together and in a sort of synchronized way pull out wallets, boxes of matches, or whatever, to act like they were taking photos back of that RCMP operative. So number one, they were exposing that person. Number two, they were telling that person in a very campy way that they were not welcome in that particular space. And there was a broader form of non-cooperation. There was a real sort of community ethics that you didn't talk to the RCMP, you didn't give names, and if you did, you would actually be shunned by other people in lesbian and gay networks at that point in time. Obviously, the forms of resistance and non-cooperation expand quite a bit in the 1970s with the emergence of our liberation movements and the possibility of people being able to resist in much more extensive and much more profound ways. But that notion of non-cooperation and resistance, which actually forced the RCMP to shift its strategies and tactics on a number of occasions, is a very important conclusion that we draw from the research we did for the Canadian War on Queers.
And could you bring us up to today from where you left off, right up to today and where we're what we're looking at now for the liberation of queer people?
For sure. What happens in the 1980s, as I was mentioning before, is first of all, we have a massive expansion of our communities. They become more public and visible. We have a massive expansion of our movements. In Toronto, for instance, after the successful resistance, or largely successful resistance, to the 1981 bathhouse raids, where more than 300 men were arrested, and there were then demonstrations of thousands and thousands of people in the streets of Toronto, what you see is a sort of shift in the relationship of forces. That gets combined with the enactment in 1985 of the Equality Rights section of the Charter, which grants limited formal rights to a whole series of groups of people in Canadian society. At that point in time, it doesn't explicitly mention lesbians and gay men, but over the years, and with legal battles and with our movements growing, it's read to include lesbian and gay rights. What that then means is that we can use the Equality Rights section of the Charter to try to go after the remnants of the national security campaign in the public service, and eventually, in the early 1990s, the continuing purge campaigns that continue to exist and have actually escalated within the military. So we're able to pretty well utilize the Equality Rights section of the Charter to advance our struggles on sort of the formal legal level. We're able to begin to win certain forms of formal legal equality with heterosexuals in Canadian society. That's not necessarily the same as substantive social equality. We still have lots of hatred, lots of forms of oppression and marginalization directed against lesbians and gay men. But we certainly have made major advances on the front of sort of our individual formal legal rights. Now, it should be pointed out that one of the last bastions to fall on an official level is the Canadian military. There's an awful lot of resistance also to the inclusion of queer people in the RCMP and also in CSIS. But by the late 1980s, that begins to crumble on an official level. The military maintains adamant opposition to the inclusion of lesbians and gay men right up until they are forced in the Michelle Douglas decision to get rid of their discriminatory policies and to agree that they can include lesbians and gays in the military. But it's also important to understand that they never did any popular education in the military, in the military ranks, around homophobia and heterosexism. That was not their idea. Their idea was that they would assimilate some lesbians and gay men into the military, basically assimilate those individuals into a largely heterosexist institution, which is what they have attempted to do since 1992. Now, there's been continuing struggles within the military, and clearly there's still lots of informal practices of discrimination and exclusion that exist there. But there certainly have been continuing battles that have improved the situation for lesbians and gay men. So part of what I would want to suggest is that by the end of the 1990s, most of the aspects of the Canadian War on Queers, the national security campaigns against lesbians and gay men, have been at least officially done away with. That doesn't mean they're not still sort of unofficially there. Areas that they remain in to this day are, for instance, if someone applies for a security clearance from the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service, which still does security clearance work for civil servants, and they discover that you or your partner have something that you're hiding, i.e. that you're lesbian or gay and are not fully out about it, perhaps maybe just not out to your parents about it. Perhaps you have aging parents and you don't really want to talk to them about this because you think it might, you know, be something that they wouldn't want to hear and you don't want to put them in any level of distress. You could still be denied a security clearance in the public service. So in that sense, it's also important to realize that the war on lesbians and gay men is not entirely over, even though we were successful in dismantling and undermining the major aspects of those national security campaigns.
To find out more about Gary Kinsman's book, The Canadian War on Queers, please visit the Pride Library to pick up a hard copy or order online at ubcpress.ca. You are listening to Queer Review on CHRW 94.9. Queer Review broadcasts every other Tuesday at 6:30, and all shows will be uploaded to chrwradio.com and queerreviewradio.blogspot.com.
We're not.